It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. It was 1948. How does a teenager who was intended to be only a temporary replacement in the Missing Persons Bureau wind up having a decorated 40-plus year career? Therese Rocco ultimately became Pittsburgh's first female assistant police chief, a topic she discusses in detail in her self-titled memoir. I spoke with her earlier this week at her home in Brookline. Therese, thanks for visiting with us today.
It's my pleasure.
You were 19 when you joined the department. From what you wrote in the memoir, you seemed a little bit hesitant to take that position. Why so?
Absolutely. Primarily because of my background. I attended a Catholic school, grade school and high school. I had parents. My mother she didn't speak English. My father did. And they were very strict, and I was controlled, and knew nothing about the world in terms of morality or immorality, and it was very frightening.
At that time, the Missing Persons Office was staffed by women only. Why?
Well, because it was considered a very insignificant problem. Runaway children, and men did not feel that they should be involved in such an insignificant problem. So the women were assigned to the missing persons. And most of our cases were small children who walked away from home. Unfortunately, children who were abandoned, children who were cast away, and there were many, many, which of course today we are faced with that problem, but it was more insurmountable in those years.
What were you expected to do? Type, file, what?
I didn't know what to expect. I needed a job because of helping my family. We needed the money. My brother had just recently come home from the service. My sister was married. My father was not well, and he only lived a year after I was on that job. And I was fortunate to know a gentleman who was very, very close to Governor Lawrence.
So the good news is you were able to get that job immediately because you didn't have to get training at the police academy. The bad news is you and the other women at the time did not receive academy training.
Absolutely not. We were just considered, women, and most of them looked at us in terms of, you know, we need a cake for a celebration. But I was not one of those gals.
How did that affect your frame of mind, even your ability to do the job, that being shut out of getting that training?
Well, I was very fortunate to meet a woman who was in charge. She was second in command, but I have to thank her because she took me under her wing. She was very competent, no education, but she knew her stuff, and I hung on to her.
You write, for some, maybe many, the idea of an armed, uniformed woman in the field was preposterous.
Oh, yes. That was unbelievable. In fact, it was suggested later in years, and the superintendent of police at the time says, we couldn't do that. We'd put guns in these women's hands. They'd have an argument. They would kill each other. This is the way they looked at us.
One of your duties was to be a decoy, to act as bait. So you were unarmed. You had no self-defense training, but you were often put in harm's way. What was that like?
Perhaps because of my youth, I didn't consider the danger. I was brave. I thought I could do it. You know, I would be shaking in my boots, you know, but I did it. It didn't seem too much.
Did you always trust your male partners in such an operation?
Yes. They were men who were old enough to be my father. And in spite of the fact that, you know, they were very caring, they protected us, and especially me, because I was much younger than all the others. They were not expected to do what I was doing. I had to do all the sex, you know, immorality problems that occurred because of my youth, and I had to do them.
Well, one example that you write about in your memoir, you were bait for a man who was molesting women in a downtown movie theater. This turns out you actually infuriated your partner in this case. Why so?
Well, you know, when I first heard of decoy, I didn't even know what the word meant. And you're going to be somebody that you're not. You're going to act. And he explained that this was a predator who molested women in this theater, and it was going on quite frequently. So the gentleman who I was with, the detective, Iggy Burkowski, we worked quite a bit and taught me a lot on the street. He told me that you go up front, you sit there, the minute he makes a move on you, lift the hand. But I was so infuriated. He leaned over and he grabbed my leg and he was pushing it over. All I could think of, what a nerve this guy has. He got up and ran and I chased him.
But here you are, unarmed, chasing a guy who could have been armed.
Yeah, he could have turned around and cracked me. And then I saw Iggy running and I ran and I grabbed the guy. He fell and I pulled down his pants.
You stopped him.
I stopped him. That's what I said to him. He went, ooh. He was so upset with me. And I said, oh, detective. I said, we got him. We got him.
You eventually made a name for yourself and the department within the Bureau, across the region, even nationwide, for your dogged, effective work in locating missing children. What about that particular work fueled you?
I loved it. I just got into it so deeply. These kids became my kids. And I'd never hesitated to give them my phone number at home if I thought I could help them. In my career, I do remember many, many children that I got put on the right path. And I think that's the greatest joy I feel today, knowing that I could go somewhere and somebody could come up to me and say, do you remember me? But of course, when they talk about the situation, I do. And they say, thank you. And you know, that's a great feeling.
Not all the cases ended happily. One case especially really affected you. June 7, 1962, 10-year-old Marianne Verdecchia disappeared from her Bloomfield neighborhood. The entire police department paid attention. You write you never felt greater anxiety, scrutiny of the media, fears of the neighborhood. Why so?
I think because of the situation that that child was involved in. She came from parents, the mother had taken off when she was only 5 years old. The father was an alcoholic. An aunt who I admired and liked very, very much was raising her. And Marianne was a lonely child. And I could envision this little girl going from place to place, trying to get affection and attention. And she just became a part of my life. And to this day, I'm holding on to that case. We know who did it, but we can't prove it.
So more than 50 years later, the case is still technically open. Do you believe it will get solved? And you said you know who did it. You haven't been able to prove it yet. Do you think it is still possible?
I absolutely do. Because I'm on it. I'm not letting it go. I have a file that is, you would be amazed. But I believe, I couldn't believe that we got this far. You know, that we learned this much. But I do believe. I think I know who did it. I know the situation. But it's proving it.
How have you been able to deal with the heartache and the cases that did not end well, whether it was while you were on the job or even off the clock in your home?
Very, very hard. There were times when I couldn't let go. I'd come home and I'd be on the phone and sometimes they would awaken me at 3-4 in the morning. But I was always with it. I knew what the cases were. I wanted to be involved. And if they became a part of my life, like a duty, I was cut out to do this.
I believe you were on the job about a dozen years or so.
when you and other women in the department finally started getting academy training, did that change how you approached the job at all?
Well, fortunately, we became under the direction of a gentleman named Gene Kuhn. And till this day, I have to give this man credit. As soon as he became the assistant chief of police, he called me in, and I sat there. And I gave him a total, complete rundown of how discriminated we were being in terms of not being allowed to go. He says, why aren't you people coming to the meetings in the morning? We were never allowed to. I mean, it was unbelievable. He changed all that.
Of course, Gene Kuhn went on to become Allegheny County Sheriff for many years. Yeah. You were eventually made captain. Some might think, hey, that's not too bad. But you were getting paid, as you write, the equivalent of a lower-ranked sergeant. Many other women in your department were getting paid even less than that. There was a class action discrimination suit for equal pay. You weren't part of that suit, but you testified for the plaintiffs. Did the court decision help the overall picture for women officers?
Absolutely. I testified 2 days, and I read reports of what these women accomplished. I described how they were discriminated for many years, how they were underpaid. They won the case. And I had no idea that I was being considered part of that case. And I thought, well, I don't care. You know, I didn't sue. I never sued. I never complained. And before the case was decided by this judge, they came to me and they offered me equal pay. And I said, what about the women? Oh, you're not part of that. I didn't sign immediately, and I thought about it. And I consulted a friend who was an attorney, and he said, sign it and get the money. On his advice, I did it, which was bad advice.
Because you didn't get back pay.
I didn't get back pay, which was almost $21,000 or $26,000. But I had a fabulous little mother who was so, she didn't think money meant anything. And I remember right in this very house, she slept in there and I was up, I couldn't sleep. It bothered me. I didn't complain, but it bothered me. I said, how could they do this to me? As loyal as I've been, as helpful, I did for all of them. I would do their investigations, thinking and thinking. My mother said, she said, are you worried about money? I said, yeah, we could use it. She said, look, did they take your reputation away from you? I said, no. Are they saying you're somebody you're not? I said, no. She said, go to bed and forget the money. So there you are. I never thought about the money after that.
Well, they might not have recognized you monetarily, but they did recognize your investigative skills.
Oh, did they ever? I remember a detective coming to me and saying, how do you do all this? I says, I investigate. And I says, why don't you do it? He says, I don't have time. I'm out on the street. Well, I'm doing more than you're doing, honey.
So through the lens of hindsight, how much did becoming Pittsburgh's first female assistant police chief feel important at the time? And the second part of that is, how important was it that Pittsburgh's first and still only woman mayor, Sophie Maslov, administering the oath mean to you?
Well, Sophie was a wonderful mayor. She was down to earth. She was not absorbed in herself. She was very much like myself. We were concerned about people, and that's the way Sophie was. And Sophie and Rita Kane, they befriended me, and they treated me wonderful. So Rita said to Sophie, Sophie, we have to do something for this woman because the men are not going to do it. And it was Sophie who eventually appointed me assistant chief.
The Bureau's missing persons department still includes quite a few female officers, investigators. All of them, of course, have received academy training equal to their male colleagues. What hopes do you have for that department, that office, for the women working there and in the coming years?
Well, I believe that Missing Persons Bureau is probably the most important of all investigative units because it involved everything. It involved everything. We were the people who encountered a child. We questioned that child. We could go to a person in the burglary, in the robbery, and in the homicide, and give them more information than they could have got from anyone. And this is what we were doing. And I'm not bragging, but I think that I was able to cultivate this in departments all over the county.
Final question. So what advice would you give to young women today considering police work or who have just begun police work?
I would consider any young woman accepting any assignment that she's given. Don't walk into a police department and say, oh, I don't think I'm going to like doing that. You're going to love it. No matter where you begin, no matter what you do, it's a learning process. It's something that cultivates your knowledge and entitles you to learn everything there is to know, more than your male, because they're determined, they're men, that we're going to do a man's job. But most of the things that we do are not all a man's job.
The memoir is Therese Rocco, Pittsburgh's first female assistant police chief. Therese Rocco, thanks so much for talking with us, and thanks for your decades of service to Pittsburghers.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to talk about my experiences because they've never left my heart. And I am here for anyone who needs help today. Knock on my door.
A documentary about Therese Rocco premieres March 7th at the Hines History Center. You're listening to The Confluence.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, the old residence of Pittsburgh and Western Pennsylvania, later known as the Hines History Center, is founded in 1859. The organization is the region's oldest cultural preservation business and operates the History Center and Western PA Sports Museum in the Strip District, Meadowcroft Rock Shelter in Washington County, and the Fort Pitt Museum downtown. Its current home used to be the Chautauqua Lake Ice Company. It physically houses thousands of Western Pennsylvania documents in its library and archives, which are available to the public. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. More than 3,900 business events professionals are in Pittsburgh this week to talk about best practices for planning major events, including selecting locations that hopefully include Pittsburgh in the future. More than half of the attendees are meeting planners who make those destination decisions for their associations and conventions. I dropped by the conference at the David L. Lawrence Convention Center on Monday afternoon to chat with Craig Davis, president and CEO of Visit Pittsburgh, which is hosting the event.
Craig, welcome to the Confluence.
Thanks so much.
Craig, for those who won't get down here, what's so important about hosting a conference like PCMA?
Well, it's an opportunity for us to really show the city to people who have the potential to choose the city for their future convention. So there are 4,000 people at this particular conference, most of whom have the responsibility of booking their future convention. So we are sitting on a treasure trove of customers.
What kind of sessions are we talking about? What kind of vendors are on site?
Well, there are other cities like us, and there are other people that supply the meetings network. So software developers, food and beverage suppliers, you know, and hotel companies, they all want a piece of this business. And for us, the opportunity to have them in our city is free advertising for us.
I think it's safe to say that you'd like to see several of these delegates back in Pittsburgh in the future with their own conventions and conferences.
That's the whole thing. And for us, the great opportunity is the fact that when we've been taking kind of straw polls while we've been around, we've been asking people by show of hands, how many people have been to Pittsburgh before? Or haven't been, rather, 60% or plus of the groups will actually put their hand up. So we know instinctively that people are going to fall in love with the city because they didn't know what to expect. So to give you an example, you go to a certain city and you expect to have your socks blown off. Fair to say that in many cases, people are not expecting that in Pittsburgh. But because they become so enamored with it while they're here, they really and truly do fall in love with it.
So what kind of lasting impact can this have with these exhibitions on Pittsburgh, the small businesses that are here, et cetera?
Let me give you an example. Just having PCMA in the city this week will leave about $6.1 million in direct spending, and that is in all the hotels, restaurants, Ubers, taxis, everybody here is entertaining customers, and they are using all of our facilities. In fact, I just spoke with one of the delegates who went down to the Strip District and bought a coat. So they're leaving a lot of money behind. So if you take that, this is a four-day event for $6 million, which admittedly is one of the larger events. But all told, last year we did $200 million worth of meetings business. The people in this particular session are worth hundreds of millions of dollars to any city in future business.
All right. This is the big one, is it not? And has Pittsburgh ever hosted this conference before?
We have not. You know, we're calling this the Super Bowl of these types of conferences. This is the crown jewel. We have hosted other smaller events in a similar vein, but nothing like this, not even close.
I understand that there are event planners from other countries here. So what about Pittsburgh might attract an international conference here?
Well, first of all, we are actually having direct flights that are starting from London, England in April. And we have direct flights that are coming in from Frankfurt over the summer. So that is a very big determinant as to whether they choose a city. So for us, this is really a big opportunity for us.
All right. So what do you want to showcase about Pittsburgh beyond the facilities? Okay, we have hotels, we've got the convention center, but what is it that you want people to see and experience so that they might want to come back here with their events?
You make a great point. You know, a lot of cities have wonderful hotels, have a great convention center. Pittsburgh has those. What we're selling to them is the uniqueness of the city. We're selling to them the 90 different neighborhoods, each with its own food, with its own traditions. You know, there's something very, our architecture, our arts and culture really sets us apart. And our food scene has been the thing that has really changed the way that we sell the city. And so we want them to leave here knowing that we can really hold up against big cities and small cities. But the thing is that Pittsburgh is still very authentic. And the people here are incredible to our visitors. I think that there's still a sense here that they're happy when somebody comes in and loves the city. And it's not unusual for local Pittsburghers to actually walk somebody to their destination. So if they say that they want to go to a specific restaurant, they'll turn around with them and walk back down the street and make sure that they arrive.
So how much of it is when you are selling the city, how much is it fun versus facilities?
Oh, I mean, it has to be both. So facilities are first. Actually, you sell the city first. So the city has to be centrally located. It has to be affordable. The facilities are a must. So you're not going to get a conference booked into a city if the conference doesn't fit into the city, unless there's an extreme circumstance. So those are check marks that are done right away. Then they start looking at what else would appeal to that particular group. So for instance, if it's a group that's based in STEM, sciences, healthcare, they would naturally gravitate towards a Pittsburgh because we already have an industry alive and well here. And, you know, even in this conference, we're borrowing from local professors, local universities. They are educating the people at PCMA, and that's a very big deal for us. So all the things that you know, energy, education, medicine, culture, those things really lend themselves. And our human capital, our intellectual capital, lends to that cell.
All right, Craig, I'm an event planner, and I say to you, really, I like what I see here. I really do, but convention center might be a bit small, or I'm concerned a little bit about the number of hotel rooms. How do you respond?
We do whatever we can to get that piece of business in. So, for instance, in this particular case, PCMA very rarely goes to a city the size of Pittsburgh. Next year, for instance, they're going to San Francisco. We're a little bit on the small side. So, as a result, we went to our hotel community, who would normally give a certain percentage of their inventory to a convention, and we asked them to really push those bounds, and they did. So there's a convention that comes in once in a while, every 3 or 4 years, called the National Black Engineers. It's NSBE. And they had outgrown Pittsburgh a couple years ago, but they love the city so much that they just make it work. So they're staying, last time they stayed in 22 different hotels. It's almost unheard of. So it can happen, but for the very most part, we are competing against other cities our size, other cities that are larger than us, and it comes down to rates, dates, and space, and then also the appeal of the city. And then you know, what the cost of the convention center is, what the cost of doing business is. It all factors in. But our job at Visit Pittsburgh is to mediate the customer and the supplier to make sure we can get the best deal for the best time. And I think our city does very, very well in providing that.
Craig Davis is the president and CEO of Visit Pittsburgh. Thanks, Craig. Good luck to you this week.
Thanks so much.
And you're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The partial government shutdown is now in its 19th day, making it the second longest shutdown in U.S. government history. We're going to discuss how that shutdown is affecting the Pittsburgh region with Jamie Martinez, reporter with the Pittsburgh Tribune Review, and Anlie Herring, government accountability reporter for WESA. Jamie, Anlie, welcome to The Confluence.
Thanks for having us.
All right. So we have two major areas of impact: federal workers themselves and all those programs that receive federal funding, support, grants, but are administered maybe at the state or local level. So at this point, who's hurting the most, would you say, at this point? Jamie?
The officials that I've spoken to from the county level and some of the other departments around, you know, our area, it's kind of a, we could be hurting, but not yet. So still waiting to see what the impact is going to be.
That's exactly what I've heard as well, speaking with people from the county and some of the local nonprofits who rely directly or indirectly on federal funding. Right now, it really is the federal workers who are feeling the impact because they're either furloughed or working without pay. But outside of that, people say eventually there could be serious effects on things like food stamps and filing taxes and right, things like that.
I know, I'm going to talk a little bit about, so do we have any numbers of workers who are affected, either told to stay home or you got a report for your job, but you're not getting paid?
So nationwide, the estimate is that 800,000 federal employees are affected, and just over half of those are said to be working without pay. Within Pennsylvania, the Center for American Progress, which is a left-leaning organization, says over 12,000 employees are either furloughed or working without pay.
So 12,000 where, only in Pennsylvania?
In Pennsylvania, okay. That's right.
Right, okay. Jamie, there are the federal employees who are designated as essential. These include folks like with TSA, right? Do we know of any impact at Pittsburgh International Airport?
When I spoke with representatives from the airport late last week, coming into the third week of the shutdown, they told me they weren't seeing anything yet. When I checked the website this morning, it looked like wait times were about normal. But around the country, there have been some reports that there are some workers calling off sick or they are starting to experience some longer wait times. I've also seen reports that call-offs aren't quite as high as they might sound. So I think we're still taking a wait and see approach to see if, you know, airports closer to home here in Pittsburgh are going to be affected.
Right. And we can't really say that those call-offs are due to the shutdown. It could be flu season, right?
Sure, of course. And some of the numbers I've seen have put from, you know, from TSA spokespeople, that they're only about 1 percentage point higher, you know, 4% versus 3% around this time last year.
Mm-hmm. So what other federal workers in our region are affected? Give us a sense who else is affected in terms of federal workers.
I've heard reports that people working for Department, you know, the Housing and Urban Development, they've been affected. I've also heard mostly from folks who are experiencing it indirectly. So, for example, out in Westmoreland County, where they're relying on two federal grants to pay some people in their public safety department, that money isn't coming through. However, those employees are getting paid through county funds, and they'll eventually get reimbursed. Another organization, the Blackburn Center out in Westmoreland County, they work with survivors of domestic violence. They rely on some money that would have been dispersed through the appropriations bill. So that funding isn't coming through. So like we've already mentioned, it's a lot of indirect sort of ripple effects that are starting to, impact people on the ground.
Veterans hospitals, for instance, they're open. They have to serve their clients, their patients. But there's a funding issue for them. Is that correct?
As far as I know, they're operating regularly, but it could end up being another down the line.
What do we know about federal courts? We have U.S. District Court for Western Pennsylvania here. What do we know about the federal courts?
The extent of what we know at this point is that civil cases have been put on hold. The U.S. Attorney Scott Brady in Western Pennsylvania addressed this in a statement saying that the office would proceed with criminal cases because, of course, you bump up against constitutional guarantees of speedy trials and defendants' rights in those cases.
But how long can they do that? How long do they have the money to do it, and where are they getting any money right now?
So the date on that is January 11th.
Friday.
Friday, yeah. And that's also the day that many federal workers are going to be missing their first paycheck. So that Friday is a big day for you know, workers. It's a big day for courts. Courts, like U.S., have been running on money that they've kind of had in reserves from fees or leftover money. But that could run out by Friday. And each local, you know, federal court will be making decisions on staffing.
And the biggest case that people have their eye on that's currently working its way through the federal court system is the Bowers case, the alleged gunman in the Tree of Life Synagogue. Did Scott Brady say anything about that in investigators or anything?
Well, that is a criminal case. So I think as far as anyone knows, that's proceeding as was expected originally. There is a broader point, though, that there's just so much uncertainty that this shutdown creates. Right now, we think the court is going to be relying on the funds it has in reserve from court fees and other sources. But you saw earlier this week that the Trump administration looked at the IRS and saw that tax refunds could have been held up if nothing was done. And they said, no, we're going to make sure that that work continues. And then with food stamps, they found a way to fund it, they say, through February.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit more about those. So what action? So you're an affected federal employee. You're not getting paid. You are told to stay home. You're furloughed. What, if any, action can they take? Can they file for unemployment?
Yes, they can. And I checked with the state Department of Labor and Industry. They said that there was more than a bit of a spike at the end of December. So during the first full week of the shutdown. So in Pennsylvania, they told me that there were 455 initial unemployment compensation claims compared to 48 of those claims that were made at the end of December during the comparable week. So again, they can't say exactly why it happened. Those are just the numbers, but there was some type of spike. I've heard reports coming in around the country, though, that some employees are having trouble applying for unemployment because they can't access the documents they need through, you know, the government portals that are shut down. So again, in Pennsylvania, they can apply for unemployment. And we are seeing a bit of a spike there.
All right. In his nationwide address Tuesday night, President Trump repeated his message since day one of the shutdown that the Democrats are to blame. Sources that you have spoken to for your reporting, are they blaming one side or the other, President Trump or the House Democrats, or are they just pointing fingers in the direction of Washington, period?
I've mostly talked to people who provide social services at local nonprofits, and none of those individuals are blaming one party or the other, but they all share the view that this shutdown really should come to an end, and that's what they're hoping for.
What are you hearing, Jamie?
I'm hearing about the same. A lot of there's a deal to be made, and we have to get to it sooner rather than later.
All right. Well, state and local officials have not hesitated to condemn the shutdown. Anli, you reported on State Auditor General DePasquale when he was trying to demonstrate, show the impact, the repercussions of the shutdown on Pennsylvania. What point was he trying to make?
He was saying there would be these big ripple effects. He pointed to a hit that consumer confidence could take. He says that would affect job creation and the collection of income taxes. He did say that it would affect the stock market and that we had already seen that on account of the volatility we're seeing there. But that's been attributed to our trade dispute with China. Just last week, Apple scaled back its projections for sales because of competition with China. So That's a bit of a tenuous claim, but his biggest point is that this will have broader effects than people might be feeling now if this continues.
Right. You alluded to the food stamps, and we got word late yesterday afternoon, early evening from the U.S. Department of Agriculture that it will provide food stamps through February. Anlie, you spoke with Lisa Scales, head of the Greater Pittsburgh Community Food Bank. They were trying to bolster their supplies. Is that still going to happen just in case this extends longer and even beyond the February food stamps?
Well, I have not followed up with Lisa since the announcement was made last night, but she did realize that there is a large potential impact of a continued shutdown if it does cut off food stamps. She said that in a single month in Pennsylvania, that amounts to 12,000 million meals. Her organization helps to provide 3 million meals per month. So I think she does see a need to be prepared depending on any contingency.
Jamie, speaking of food, interesting point in your reporting was the potential impact on Pennsylvania farmers. How so?
Right. So local farm service agencies are close, and they're the agency that distributes funds from the USDA. So those could be loans that help farmers buy equipment or seeds or any, you know, loans to offset operating costs. So some of the union representatives who represent farmers in Pennsylvania told me that if those offices don't reopen, they might not be able to get their crops ready for the spring.
Do we know what crops that might affect at this point, or is it still to be determined?
Still to be determined. They told me likely larger farms, big grain farms, dairy farms. But again, I touched base with a few farmers who told me that they're watching it, but they're not panicking just yet.
Okay. The battle is not just between the President and House Democrats. WESA spoke with Senator Bob Casey about blocking other legislation unrelated in the Senate until the government shutdown is over. That sounds like a Senate shutdown over a government shutdown.
Yeah, it kind of does. Senator Casey spoke with my editor, Chris Potter, and he said that he voted against a bill he actually supported because he thinks Congress and the Senate need to be focusing on ending this shutdown as opposed to voting on other legislation.
In our remaining minute or so, to both of you, if this continues to move forward, this shutdown, what are aspects of the impact of the shutdown that you plan to be following up on? And Jamie, in your reporting, you alluded to some of the social service agencies, even a women's program in Westmoreland County.
Right. So I'll be keeping tabs on, of course, how it's impacting workers. And if there are any workers locally who want to share their stories, I'd encourage them to reach out. And again, the services that are going to be affecting people day to day.
Yeah, I'm most interested in impact on social services as well. I'm curious to know if someone loses access to food stamps, how will they manage to pay for their groceries?
Right. And so you plan on revisiting some of the people you talked with in your reporting up to this point if it continues to linger on?
Yeah, absolutely. I was sending emails before we walked into the studio this morning, so we'll be watching.
All right. Jamie Martinez is a reporter for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Anlie Herring is government and accountability reporter for WESA. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance by Meg Fair and Julia Zenkevich. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.